Just to get started, because we're week five, so now we're halfway through, and now we're entering into the deep topics of this course, Introduction to Tantra, which is an in-depth course anyway. So what we've already covered in 4 short weeks, the six names of Tantra, which is a way of explaining how unique Tantra is. We've looked at what the foundation of Buddhist Tantra is, which is a foundation of the Lam Rim, because there are all different types of Tantra, but Buddhist Tantra, with the goal of Buddhahood, has a foundation of the Lam Rim. We've looked at the qualities that we need to develop as a student and what our responsibilities are, and how we cultivate our own mind. And then once we've done that, the qualities of a Vajra master. So that's similar to the qualities of a master within sutra, but then extras. There's extras when it comes to tantra. So how to actually check if they're a qualified teacher, because we are going to be putting our entire well-being, and in fact this life and all future lives, is going to rely on our relationship with the Vajra master. So we have to pick well. And then we looked at the three gates to enter tantra. Does anyone remember what those are? Ben, go for it. Refuge. Who's got the second?
Bodhicitta.
Bodhicitta. Who's got the third? Initiated. That's right. There we go. No, that's the three principal aspects of the path. There are lots of lists of three. And then we looked at the four classes of Tantra and how they're distinguished by how much blissful energy you can handle without getting into trouble or without getting overwhelmed. So mostly we looked at Action Tantra and Highest Yoga Tantra, and we also will mostly focus on those for the rest of the course, because they are the initiations that are mostly given. The way that we distinguish the levels of Tantra, remember, uses that analogy of the universal analogy of a relationship of falling in love. So just gazing or looking at someone, you know, it's fairly nice. When they glance back at you, well, that's pretty nice as well. Then the first thrill of, say, touching hands, it's quite different from just looking at them across the room. But the thrill of first touching hands to the explosion of mental and physical bliss with union in Highest Yoga Tantra is just extraordinary, the difference. So how much blissful energy can we take onto the path to enlightenment without getting sidetracked, without getting in overwhelmed? And there were two analogies that we had for how do we use bliss, or more importantly, the energy of bliss on the path. Does anyone remember what those analogies are? Ben's got one. Which one? So the ant, they say, is born from the wood, so it lives in the wood. But in the process of living in the wood, it destroys the wood. So it's like using the energy of the blissful energy in the process to destroy the affliction of. So using the energy actually destroys the affliction of grasping attachment. Does anyone remember the other analogy?
Like a vaccine.
Like a vaccine. Thank you very much, Ian. So a vaccine, actually, it doesn't counter the disease. It uses the poison of the disease to overcome the disease. And that's really quite different in the tantric approach, that you use whatever energy, the energy of attachment, the energy of jealousy, the energy of anger, even the energy of ignorance, you use that to counter those afflictions. Maisie Jane asked a question last week about taking grasping onto the path, and I wasn't happy with my answer. So I've been thinking about this. You know, in the 12 links, how we have contact, feeling, craving, grasping, and they go in a row like that psychologically. So in Tantra, it's like you have contact, feeling, but nothing, there's no craving and grasping that follows from that. Because you've got renunciation, you've got bodhicitta. So you have those two, and you use the energy of contact and feeling to overcome craving and grasping. I know, isn't it great? So thank you, Maisie Jane. Was going around in my mind all week, and I thought, oh no, I've got to really say a little bit more because she brought it up about the grasping. So that's what we've already covered. What we're going to look at today is about the substantial cause of Buddhahood. So if we don't have a substantial cause of Buddhahood, there is no Buddhahood. So what is the substantial cause of Buddhahood? What's the cause of a Buddha's wisdom, mind of a Buddha? What's the cause of a Buddha's activity or communication, the body and speech of a Buddha, of all the different manifold forms of a Buddha? So all of the work for oneself really is for self-liberation, nirvana, but the work for others, so that we can help others, is to achieve Buddhahood. So if we want to achieve Buddhahood, we need the substantial cause. So what we're going to have a look at, well, what exactly is a Buddha in that case, and then what are the substantial causes? And so I'm going to include a little a reminder from Geshe Thich Nhat Hanh, the Australian Geshe Thich Nhat Hanh. When we were in Newmarket, there was this huge mango tree in the back, and he'd say, look, no mango seed, no mango tree. You can go into your backyard and you can dig a hole and you can pray over that hole for mangoes. You're not going to get mangoes. You can have single point of concentration. You're not going to get mangoes unless you put the mango seed in there. That's the only way. So, no matter how hard we pray, we absolutely have to make sure that we have the substantial cause for all four bodies of a Buddha. So, in a way, when we're going to look at the four bodies of a Buddha, what a Buddha is, and then what the substantial causes are, this class is a little bit like that movie Inception. You know, you go in a layer and then boom, you're into the next layer and it goes down. Anyone seen Inception? Yeah, okay. Well, if you haven't, this is your homework. And then we'll come crashing back out the five layers as well. But let's start with saying some of our prayers. So for our prayers, I've changed the picture so that it has Guru Vajradhara as the image now, because we're beginning to really talk about Tantra. So we can think that out of the spaciousness of your mind, so out of the vastness of space, appears the, I mean, that is the Dharmakaya. And out of that appears blue Vajradhara, which is like the light body of the tantric emanation of the Buddhas. And then for, to really make it personal, you can think with the face of your guru or the face of His Holiness. And so we will recite the prayers, remembering it's refuge in bodhicitta, so it's a Mahayana refuge. The seven limb prayer. Jai Ram, And offering a mandala to Guru Vajradhara. Right, so let's dive right in, looking at what a Buddha is. And so a Buddha is made up of a body and mind, of course, and the body and mind of a Buddha, they're not separate, but they're like two sides of the same coin, you know, they're different aspects. And actually, when we look at, we can either look as two, body and mind, or we can look as four bodies of a Buddha. So it's not like four bodies of a Buddha, four Buddhas walk into a bar, kind of four bodies. It's actually four components of a Buddha, like bodies of reality. And or corpus of qualities, so a collection of qualities. And I thought I've got a couple of readings. So this one from Reginald Ray, just to from this Secret of the Vajra World, page 13, just to kind of set the scene. So Tibetans believe that the Buddha, as a realized being, manifests himself on many different levels. Following Indian tradition, they divide these levels into three primary bodies. First is the Nirmanakaya, emanation body, the Buddha's physical human form, in which, as described in his early biographies, he appears as a prince, renounces the world, and follows the path to enlightenment. So that's also the Buddha as known by the Theravada, the Sanskrit, sorry, the Pali tradition. So the historical Buddha. Second, the Buddha appears as the Sambhogakaya, the body of enjoyment, his brilliant, transfigured, non-physical form of light. In this body, he journeys to the heavens, teaches the gods, and reveals himself to highly attained people. So, for instance, over here in the Tanka, there's Amitabha Buddha, so a Sambhogakaya form of the Buddha in the Pure Land. And finally, there is the Buddha's Dharmakaya, the body of reality itself, without specific delimited form, wherein the Buddha is identified with the spiritually charged nature of everything that is. So let's have a look what these are. So if we're looking at divided into two, we've got the mind and the body. So the mind, the Dharmakaya, this without specific form, identified with the spiritually charged nature of everything that is. So the mind is called the wisdom body or the Dharmakaya, and it's unobstructed mind. And it's actually when we achieve the, you know, the Dharmakaya, it's the pure, it's the sorry, the accomplishment of your own purpose. It's our own purpose. Attained through dependence on wisdom realizing emptiness. So unobstructed mind. And then, so that's usually when we're talking about the Dharmakaya, we're talking about this top section there or both of them together. But actually there is two. One's the wisdom truth body and one's the wisdom nature body. So the truth body is the wisdom, the ultimate wisdom. And it's the omniscient, purified mind of a Buddha. So developed to all the qualities of the mind developed to their ultimate potential. And it's a conscious state of the Buddha's mind that understands everything that there is to be known. So omniscient mind itself. Fully seeing every single sentient being, completely effortlessly understanding every single sentient being. And because this is a kind of, it's a wisdom that, it's not like implanted, it's a wisdom that's innate wisdom. We all have the seed of this, but it's just brought to fruition. So this kind of wisdom isn't separate from our own qualities. It's just like we're still a seedling. We haven't actually grown into the result yet. And so, of course, the causes for this are meditations on wisdom realizing emptiness. And the wisdom nature body, I might get these up so you can see the truth body, the wisdom nature body, so on the left-hand side as well, is a very interesting body because it's not actually a body, it's an emptiness. It's the clear light nature of the Buddha. So if you're going to say, well, what's the essence of a Buddha's mind? You'd say this. This is the essence of a Buddha's mind. It's clear light nature, meaning it's emptiness. So it's where all of the stains, the afflictions, everything has been completely purified. And this is also a very interesting component because there's no cause for this one. It's permanent because the emptiness of a Buddha's mind is permanent. there's no cause. On the other side, we've got the body of a Buddha. So if you're talking about, if you're dividing the two, body and mind, mind would be Dharmakaya and body is Rupakaya. The Rupakaya also has two aspects, the enjoyment body and the emanation body. And the Rupakaya, the sole purpose to have this form of a Buddha, the light body of a Buddha, isn't for the purpose of the Buddha, it's for the purpose of others. So if we, you know, we want to become liberated from samsara, we can do that. We can achieve liberation or nirvana, and that's enough if that's our goal. But if our goal is to help others, we need more. We need to be able to manifest into a body to help others. And so that's the form body of a Buddha. So before I go into the details of that, I've got a couple of examples. So one great example that I loved is that, so when we're thinking of Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya and Nimanakaya, it's like a TV broadcast. So the TV broadcast is like, it's there in the ether, isn't it? It's always there. It's everywhere. We're sitting in it. But if we want to actually connect with it, we've got to tune in. So tuning in is like, you know, the light is like the Sambhogakaya and the TV show is the Nimanakaya. And of course, when we first come across it, we just think, when we first see TV, when you're a kid, you think the people are in the TV. Little people, David Lynch's little people, you know, they're really there. And then we go, oh no, actually, you know, it's some other mysterious thing is happening. There's not actually people in the TV set. But to actually think, oh, these frequencies are there around us all the time, that's a whole nother thing. Yeah, so depending how sentient beings tune in to those frequencies. So the Dharmakaya represents emptiness, the ultimate truth beyond concepts, like a spacious clear sky. The Sambhogakaya is like the radiant energy, all the enlightened qualities of a Buddha, and visualized as pure lands and deities. And when we do these visualizations, that connects us with that frequency. So it transforms our perception. At first, it's like we're just visualizing things, but actually, that visualization accords with reality. So it connects us with all of those enlightened qualities. And the Nirmanakaya aspect is like all the physical manifestations of enlightenment, like Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, like our teachers. So it brings enlightenment into the ordinary world, showing wisdom and compassion can function in ordinary life. And it's probably our first connection with the Buddhas, unless we've been blessed with having a vision or a dream. Usually our first connection with the Buddhas is through a person, a teacher. So it's not like there's any limit of these bodies. Another beautiful analogy is like wherever there is a still body of water, whether it's a huge lake or a little puddle, if the water is still, the moon can shine in it. There can be an unlimited amount of moons. You're not going to run out of moons. So we just still our mind and then we can reflect those qualities. So the enjoyment body or the Sambhogakaya, the body of light or body of bliss, remains in the Pure Lands. Only bodhisattvas can see this body, usually. It has the 32 major and 80 minor marks of a Buddha. This Buddha only teaches Mahayana. Also, what is included in this Sambhogakaya are the seed syllables and the mantras, because they are actually a subtle form. So Vajra speech, the Buddha's speech, it's like the physical form of the teachings. So mantras are counted as a Sambhogakaya form of the Buddha's. Really nice subtle form. And then also, sometimes the statues are counted as this, because even though we see the statues as made out of whatever material they are, bronze or plastic or concrete, realized beings see them not as a statue, but as what they are, the Sambhogakaya aspect. So one time at Chenrezig Institute when Lama Zopa Rinpoche visited, I'll never forget it. So of course the Gompa is completely packed, full of people, and Rinpoche comes in the back door, and to get to his throne he has to pass the life-size Tara statue, and so he came past the statue and he paused and he looked up at Tara for a very long time, and then when he sat down on the throne. He said, "You've got to get Tara better clothes because, of course, someone had brought all of these beautiful robes to adorn the Tara statue, and the robes were out of all the different metallic threads. And in the Queensland humidity, they'd tarnished, become all dark green and brown and sticky. And it was as if Rinpoche had gone up and the Tara statue had said,
Look at what I'm
Look
wearing.
at me, Rinpoche, look at me." And Rinpoche's like, "I'm so sorry about this. We're gonna have to remedy." And then he sat down, and it's like Tara's like told him the state of play, basically what's been happening. So it was really very apparent that there was a big conversation going on. To some of the holy beings, the statues can talk. I think there is a story that when His Holiness had to flee Tibet, and that one of the statues talking to His Holiness. And actually, I think there was like two statues, white Tara statue and a green Tara statue. And he'd got one of the statues to take with him and had to leave the other one. And the other one stood up and said, "You can't leave me." And it became a standing statue. I know the things that happen. So, the enjoyment body of a Buddha, the light body of a Buddha, has all of these elements. The Namanakaya aspect, the emanation body of a Buddha, is like the personality of a Buddha. And so manifesting into all different forms to be able to help sentient beings. So to help humans manifesting as a human being, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, you know, Chenrezig Buddha in person, so that we can actually connect. But also manifesting as a dog to help a bunch of dogs, and as birds to help birds, as a cow to help. I remember there was a story about a cow in a in an abattoir somewhere that all the cows are going through, and then one of the cows stopped and got onto its knees in front of the guy operating it, and a tear came out of its eye, and the guy in the abattoir just like, no, we are saving this cow. And so his whole life, of course, changed from that moment. So appearing to ordinary beings, thank goodness, but also can appear as inanimate objects, like a bridge when you need a bridge, or $20 on the ground when you absolutely need some money and you're starving, or something like that, really, to help sentient beings. And so another analogy for these, the bodies of the Buddha, like a light bulb. So electricity, that's like the Dharmakaya. And the light is like the Sambhogakaya. And all the myriad objects that are illuminated is like the Nimanakaya. So I know we've just like dive right in here. Does it make sense? Where are you confused about? Is there anything that needs? Electricity is like the Dharmakaya. So the mind, the wisdom that's all around us, it's not physical. Then the light, the actual light that illuminates things, is like the Sambhogakaya, the light body. But when you look at a light, and all of the objects that are illuminated are the Nimanakaya. Svabhavakaya, the wisdom nature body. So that's the emptiness of the Buddha's mind.
Yeah.
So that's as we develop these bodies of a Buddha, that's the true cessations. Yeah, that's right. The Buddha's not just some subjective object over there, but how we actually connect, how we even know there is light, is because things are illuminated. So that's our starting point. And then slowly, slowly it becomes apparent, oh, that's right, it's not separate. Yeah. It's pervasive. And also it's not like there's us here and the Buddha there and we are different. In essence, we're the same. It's no difference between the nature of our mind and the nature of the Buddha's mind. There's no difference. But we're disconnected. So here's a little bit. It looks like I read a lot, but I don't. What I do is I ask Eddie, hey, get me a good paragraph about this. So this is what Eddie got me. This is from Tibetan Buddhist Medicine and Psychiatry, The Diamond Healing, page 30. To explain the deep meaning of the Vajrayana, the principal method used is that of the Vajra. So Vajrayana is another word, you know, for tantric path. Vajra is a Sanskrit word, in Tibetan, dorji, meaning diamond, thunderbolt, or scepter. The inherent Buddha nature is said to be like a diamond, indestructible, pure, and empty in itself, but luminous in reflecting the manifestation of energies as rainbow light. So this indestructible nature of the mind, that's why it's called Vajrayana, because that's what it's based on. This in not only an indestructible nature of the mind, but the continuity of our mind transforming into a Buddha. It's not like it's we turn into something else. There's this continuity there. The three kayas, the three bodies of the Buddha, Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Nimanakaya, represent, in a way, the Buddhist sacred trinity of the three levels of expression of the reality of Buddha nature. They represent the unmanifest, the subtle, and the manifest levels of Buddha essence. They represent the Buddha mind, the Buddha speech, and the Buddha body. The Dharmakaya is called the absolute truth body, the Buddha mind, unborn, undying, all-pervasive voidness. So there you go, Ben, there's the all-pervasive. The Sambhogakaya is called the enjoyment body, or Buddha speech, the energetic, rainbow-like, subtle level. And the Nimanakaya is called the form body and is characterized by the unobstructed action of compassion. So that sums up like really the whole point of it is why would we even want to develop a form body? The only purpose is for others. That's the whole impetus of it.
Like
enjoyment body time. like at the spa having a good time. So enjoyment body because it is a body of bliss. So the experience of this body is blissful. It's made of light, has no aging, has no sickness, there's no defilements. And I suppose within that the enjoyment body has lots of enjoyments. So everything is an enjoyment, in fact, from this point of view. But I suppose if we were in who gets the bliss and enjoyment, so it's the Buddha's mind is, you know, the Buddha, body and mind are not separate. So the Buddha is naturally blissful. It's not flatlining. It's naturally blissful. Who gets the enjoyment? Of course, the Buddha has the enjoyment. But if we're in the presence of a Buddha or even a Nimanakaya manifestation, we also get the bliss because we bask in that aura, don't we? And we get a taste or an inkling of what it's like. And then someone like Lama Zopa Rinpoche, you know, who manifested a stroke, who had all these difficulties and was never upset. So you really get a taste of that as well. There's an enjoyment. Then even the Nimanakaya aspect, the emanation aspect, isn't an ordinary one. doesn't act ordinary. So if there's a lot more about this in the refuge unit of Discovering Buddhism. And so in the order of things, on the Tuesday mornings, we're going to do all about karma, and then there's refuge and the three jewels. So refuge in Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, we go into this, the bodies of a Buddha, in a lot more depth. Going into it in a mere 15 minutes is a bit crazy. Yes, Stefan?
And he talked about one of the bodhisattva vows would be uprooted if you tell this person that it's not possible to be kind all the time or something like
that. Yeah,
In that way, you'd be limiting them and limiting their growth. So it's really interesting how...
Yeah, to actually demonstrate that.
You see that in action.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's kind of like the principle and then you see it in action.
Yeah, so you have the teaching and the principle of you can be kind no matter what.
Yes.
And then you have someone actually demonstrating that to you when they're experiencing huge difficulties. And, I mean, even Lama Yeshe as well, he would teach going whilst having a heart attack. You know, and people didn't realise. But it didn't disturb his mind or his incredible focus either. So, you had a question as well.
No,
well, you are on class 5, so it's understandably why you're confused. So that sounds like a real bastardization of Tantra. So that sounds to me like Californian Tantra. So in the first class, we talked about the different types of Tantra. So there's Hindu Tantra. There's Buddhist Tantra, there's Sufi Tantra, and then there's a whole bastardization of it. Just like, you know, many cultures use particular substances like peyote or whatever to have an altered consciousness, and then Westerners came along and just used it to go out nightclubbing and bastardized it. So a similar thing happened. So the answer to your question is in class one, which is on YouTube. So I've given you an answer just in a long distance way. Okay, so so on one side we've got the accumulation of wisdom. That's our job. And on the other side, it's the accumulation of merit. And how we actually do that is what is specifically addressed in from the tantric point of view, because the accumulation of wisdom is throughout all of the Buddhist vehicles. The view is the same, but the accumulation of merit, that's different. So now we get into the nitty-gritty of what is the substantial cause of a Buddha's mind and a Buddha's body. Okay, so we've got what distinguishes the vehicles, Buddhist vehicles, Hinayana and Mahayana, or Pali and Sanskrit, whichever tradition, is the method, not the view. They're all Buddhist. The view makes it Buddhist. The view, wisdom, realizing emptiness. So the lower vehicles, the, you know, Hinayana says you have a motivation of renunciation, and this drives us to get out of samsara. So we want to cease our own suffering. And so it's all the practices of renunciation with wisdom realizing emptiness. With Mahayana, great vehicle because the goal is greater. It's all sentient beings. We're going to help all sentient beings. So we've got renunciation and we've got bodhicitta. So the later vehicles rely on the fulfillment of the characteristics of the earlier ones. It's not like now we've got bodhicitta and we're ditching renunciation. We're building on them. Mahayana Sutra meditates on all the practices meditating on the union of bodhicitta and wisdom realizing emptiness. And the uncommon feature of Tantra, what makes Tantra really special, is that you meditate on wisdom realizing emptiness and bodhicitta and meditating on the deity's body, the form of a deity. So that's one of the unique characteristics of Tantra. But, you know, the later vehicles rely on the fulfillment of the earlier ones. The substantial cause has to be similar to the result, because we know this from the karma unit. A substantial cause, it's the substance that turns into the result. So whatever it is turns into the result. You have to have a substantial cause. So Mahayana Sutra, all the meditations on the wisdom realizing emptiness turn into the Dharmakaya. It's the substantial cause. But where are the meditations for the substantial cause? For the rupakaya, for the form. So they're only found in the tantric vehicle. Here's the kicker. The two kayas, the form, the mind of a Buddha and the body of a Buddha, they're not separate. They're one thing. They have to be achieved simultaneously. You can't achieve one without the other. And so that means that in the perfection vehicle, there is no substantial cause for the rupakaya. So one cannot attain Buddhahood through the perfection vehicle alone. So this gets right into the nitty-gritty. This is like just the nuts and bolts of it. So the example that Eddie gave us, which I loved, is kind of like we're going along, we're in the Mahayana Sutra vehicle, the perfection vehicle, and we want to get to Sydney, but actually the instructions just get us to Newcastle. But when we get to Newcastle, then we get the rest of the instructions, which is like the tantric instructions, and that gets us there. People show us the way. But this is kind of revolutionary, isn't it? It's like, okay, to become a Buddha, we need to achieve the Dharmakaya and Rupakaya simultaneously, because a body and mind of a Buddha are not separate. They're one thing. They're unified. That's the meaning of union. So it's got to be simultaneous. So we need to have the substantial cause for the Rupakaya. All, you know, all of the Buddhist part stages have the substantial cause for the Dharmakaya, but only Tantra has a substantial cause for the Rupakaya, the body of a Buddha. The two wings of the bird, wisdom, that's right.
So
yeah.
All that method we're doing in that is all just only going to become Dharmakaya.
No, it's still method of wisdom. So it's still the accumulation of merit.
Right.
So, but it's not the substantial cause for the body of a Buddha. It's a substantial cause for merit, so that things go well, for so that you can work to eliminate the afflictions, but it doesn't turn into the physical form of a Buddha because there's no substantial cause for it.
Does the method practices?
Yeah, they do. They do. They get us to Newcastle.
Oh, okay.
They do contribute. Of course they do. But, of course, they have to be accumulated one at a time.
Serially.
That's right. Yep. Bip. They do. So the empowerment plants the seed, but meditating on them is the substantial cause, because the meditating on them turns into the result, whereas just the initiation, oh, wouldn't it be great if that just turned into the result? So the Shakyamuni Buddha, so which bit of the Rupakaya, though, Shakyamuni Buddha? Are you talking about Sambhogakaya or Nirmanakaya?
I'm talking about the Rupakaya.
That is Rupakaya, but it's got two parts.
Yeah.
So a Rupakaya is it can be both the physical human aspect of a Buddha,
yes, yes,
and it can be the light body of a Buddha, like, for instance, Amitabha and Medicine Buddha, because Rupakaya is both. It is both. So if we go back, Rupakaya is both Sambhogakaya, the light body of a Buddha, and Nirmanakaya, the emanation body as a human. So there are many Buddhas that are born on this earth that emanate as Buddhas, physically as Buddhas, but we don't necessarily recognize them. In fact, there may be one of you here. In fact, all of you may be here. But the distinguishing thing about Shakyamuni Buddha was that he demonstrated the 12 deeds. So not all the Buddhas demonstrate the 12 deeds of showing, you know, showing the way. So that's really unique to this era. And so they said there's going to be 1,000 Buddhas that show the 12 deeds, 1,000 Buddhas of this eon. Shakyamuni Buddha is the one that we have the connection with, but doesn't mean he's the only Buddha. So it is tricky with all of the Sanskrit terms, because Rupakaya is the form of, in all the types, the mantras, the seed syllables, the light body, the deities, the Sambhogakaya aspects of the Buddhas like Medicine Buddha and Amitabha. And Nirmanakaya is the historical Buddha and all the other Buddhas that we don't know about, people that have become enlightened even in our era. The illusory body, the light body, yeah, that's the Sambhogakaya. So, for instance, you might think Medicine Buddha and Shakyamuni Buddha are different, right? They're not. They're the same. Shakyamuni Buddha is the Nirmanakaya aspect. Medicine Buddha is the Sambhogakaya aspect. They're the same. Same, just different. Yeah, but there's not just one Medicine Buddha. Because you too can become Medicine Buddha. So there's a story of the Medicine Buddhas, and they started off as Nirmanakaya aspects and then became enlightened. When they became enlightened, then they manifested as Sambhogakaya aspects. No, I can't give you a brief overview of the 12 deeds. Sorry. But then... Ah, there you go. Every Poya day in Sri Lanka related, the full moon related to the 12 deeds. Thank you. Okay, so here's a little, just a tiny little bit more about these aspects, how they interrelate. And so this is from Tara the Feminine Divine by Bokar Rinpoche, page 10. So let us suppose that in a dream we meet a deity. We would be sure of the individual existence of that deity. Also, we'd be sure of the reality of the I, who upon seeing the deity would feel joy and devotion. However, in truth, the person perceiving the deity and the deity would both be manifestations from the same inexpressible essence, the mind itself. So it's great, isn't it? Of course, we know this. Where is the dream happening? It feels like it's out there, but it's all in our mind. Where is the visualization of Shakyamuni Buddha happening? Me here, Buddha there. It's all in our mind. So in the same way, for those who live on a relative level, the deities appear on a relative level, but without being separated from their essence, which is none other than the essence of the mind. So let us take Tara, for example. When we practice Tara meditation, we must make a mental effort to imagine her as she is, green in color, hands making certain mudras, legs in a definite position, adorned with various attributes and so on. In a certain way, Tara is then the creation of our psyche, and we remain, at least partially, prisoners of the idea that there is a me on the one hand and a Tara on the other. This mental creation, though, is not useless. As a reflection of the body of enjoyment, this mental creation is linked with it and allows us to approach it. Once the ultimate realization is obtained, this same Tara is no longer the fruit of any mental effort. Without her form disappearing, she reveals herself as a spontaneous expression of the absolute body, a clarity of the mind in which there is no subject and no object. Anyway, this book, you can read a paragraph and meditate on it, and read a paragraph and meditate on it. It's really quite profound. So let's have a look at actually what these substantial causes are. The four complete results of a Buddha. So this is to do with the results to do specifically with the Rupakaya. Okay, so we've got the results that we want. Abode, body, enjoyments, and the deeds. So the body, we want to have the form of a Buddha. And so whatever deity practice that is, the body of the deity one's visualized. But that body doesn't just exist in a vacuum. That body exists in an environment. And the environment of a Buddha isn't separate from a Buddha. It's like within and without are all manifestations of a Buddha's, you know, essence, experience, everything. So there's the abode. There's got to be the substantial cause of the abode of a Buddha, the pure environment, not the polluted environment of ours. Then there's the enjoyments. So Ben, yes, Buddhas have enjoyments. Sometimes they say the sport of the Buddhas or the enjoyments of the Buddhas. So everything is an enjoyment of the Buddhas. But we can think of these, what are these enjoyments for? They're not just to bliss out and have a spa. The whole purpose of becoming a Buddha is to help others. So what they are the resources of a Buddha to help others. The spiritual wealth, all of the six perfections developed to their utmost. So, you know, they haven't gone to waste. And then the deeds, what does a Buddha do? Well, a Buddha doesn't run around scratching their head, how on earth am I going to help people? Should I do this? Should I do that? A Buddha doesn't have to run around at all. A Buddha just emanates light. So the deeds of a Buddha, the Buddha spontaneously and effortlessly accomplishes the welfare of others. So these are the results. What are the substantial causes? What's going to turn into this? Are all the meditations. So let's start on the second line there, the form of a Buddha. So that's where you meditate on the appearance of a Buddha's body. So either the body in front of you, or if you've had the initiation, you arise as the body of a Buddha. From within emptiness, you arise as the body of a Buddha, of the deity. But that's not all you do. It's not that you just arise as a deity and that's it. The end, they lived happily ever after. There's also the environment, and the environment is the mandala, the palace, the inestimable mansion, all the hosts of deities. Every atom of that palace is made up of Buddhas. There's all the offerings. So you have the meditation of arising as the deity, you have the meditation on the mandala, and you can also make a physical mandala. So those sand mandalas is a map of that abode of a Buddha, the environment of a Buddha, the perfect environment. You present offerings. So presenting the offerings is the substantial cause to having the offerings and the resources and wealth of a Buddha. And then you emanate and absorb lights. So the abode, the inestimable mansion, it may or may not be explicitly in the sadhana. So if you have a long sadhana, it is there. If you have a short sadhana, you're like, where is the meditation on the mandala? It's not there, but it's implicit. So this is the benefit of being given long sadhanas as a commitment, because you don't have to go and find out, oh, there's all this other stuff I should be doing, because it's there, specifically there, the mandala. So in the Nyungne, there is the explicit description of the mandala. It's really nice. The body of a Buddha, all the different adornments representing the six perfections, all of the ways to be able to help sentient beings in whatever form it is, wrathful or peaceful. All the enjoyments, the offerings that you make. So the tantric offerings, you'd be familiar with those in, say, Tara Puja, for instance. And the deeds of a Buddha. So I love this bit because it's two parts. One part, excuse the cartoons, is sending lights to all the sentient beings. So from every pore of the Buddha's body or the deity's body, lights go out and help sentient beings. And they transform into Buddhas, and the lights absorb back to you. So it's like breathing. So it's like a continuous... It never runs out. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So Geshe Sherpa's meditations over those four days were incredible, because he kind of, in a very relaxed way, brought in all of these elements in a very natural way.
Yeah.
And he really showed me how you can have a sadhana. It's just like the nuts and bolts of the thing, but you actually tell it as a story. You live it as a story. And this thing of emanating lights and absorbing them, and how they go out, and what you see that happens. So all of this is what a Buddha actually does. And so it's often called bringing the blessings of the Buddhas, you know, back. But it's a constant activity that a Buddha does. And so when we do this in the meditation practices, this then turns into our ability to do this. So these are the actual substantial causes of the physical body of a deity, of a Buddha, the environment, all of the resources and the activity. Whereas like just the perfections, practicing the perfections, it's kind of goes around the edges, but it's not the substantial cause.
And
it's generating merit because we're practicing bodhicitta. It's purifying because we're purifying wrong view, ordinary view.
So in thinking,
yes,
ourselves,
we're cleaning ourselves internally,
so we can see,
and developing wisdom. Both, it's simultaneous,
yes.
Which is also why it's such a fast vehicle, because it's like appearing whilst empty. The whole thing is within the Dharmakaya, not separate from the Dharmakaya. So we go through it in a process so we become familiar with each bit of the process. But in actuality, it's not separate from the Dharmakaya. No, not just Buddhas. I think anyone who has realized emptiness can see.
It's a Buddha example. So what I was going to say was, is this daily practice leading us towards that route?
I suppose it could be because we are practicing the future result now.
Right.
And yes, so seeing relative and ultimate truth, and not just seeing but acting.
Yeah, and doing it like now.
Practicing now like that. So in the last little bit, I thought I'd bring in some things that make me very inspired. So one is this whole thing about visualization, why we use visualization, these meditations on the body and the abode and everything like that. So first off, because I know many people say, oh, I can't visualize, the whole thing about visualization is nothing to do with visuals. Just forget about the word visuals. Visualization is experience. So everybody can daydream. You don't need to do it with visuals. Everybody can think about the future, imagine the future, whether you do it with visuals or not. So visualization is a whole experience. And so what it does, of course, it takes the tendency of our mind to imagine things and takes that natural tendency, which we can't even stop. You know, if anybody has anxiety, for instance, you've got visualization. So we take that natural tendency and we bring it on the path to enlightenment. And so instead of dreaming about your dream house, you know how people get, I don't know if it's just Australia, but like really obsessed about their houses and renovating their houses and making them bigger or smaller or changing this and that. So instead of that, which just fixation on your house just leads to more and more attachment, actually that's like this really subverted fixation on trying to create a pure environment, but we just don't know what we're doing or how to do it. So what if we just imagine the pure environment of a Buddha? Like forget about redoing the kitchen and just meditate on the mandala, on the pure environment of a Buddha. So, and then that isn't going to lead to more attachment and dissatisfaction. That's actually going to lead to that result naturally. When we visualize, our nervous system cannot tell the difference between fiction and reality. When we're anxious, our nervous system can't tell the difference. We get adrenaline rushes and we have adrenaline burnout. When we imagine all the good things, we have endorphins and everything flowing through us. So this is like a biohack that we can use on the path to enlightenment, where we can change our entire experience. And we need to, because it's not enough just to read about this stuff and go, oh, yeah, that makes sense, or, oh, my gosh, I'm confused. We need to have a different experience. If we don't have an experience, nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to change. So this is where visualization comes in. Also, it changes the neural pathways in our brain, and it also primes our nervous system. So I remember in the 80s when they had Expo 88 and at South Bank and the Russian Pavilion, and there was this display there where they had this technique which they developed in Russia because there was hardly any money for medicines. And it was where when you take the particular medicine, you'd associate it with these specific things. So you'd imagine a particular color, say pink, you'd have the smell of a rose, you'd have the taste, they had it with taste of castor oil, unforgettable. And so then you had your dose with these things. So all of your senses were involved with taking the dose. And so after a week or so, they'd have those three things. You'd smell the rose, you'd look at the think of the pink or look at the pink, you'd have the taste of the castor oil, and they'd start minimizing the dose. But what would happen is the body would actually respond as if it was the same dose, till it got down to the smallest possible dose. Same effect, really tiny dose. So when we're doing visualization, it's a transformative method. It's not an optional extra. It's not just some silly thing. Don't feel kind of embarrassed. Oh, it's just play acting, all of these things. This is a biohack to help us become a Buddha. This is how we do it.
It's enrolling the senses.
Yep, enrolling the senses. Yep.
Familiarizing.
Yes. Yeah. So again, it's like all of the experiences of the senses, instead of being taken away by them, overwhelmed by them, grasping it more, want a nice smell or a nice color, and then our attachment increasing, it's using that power of the senses and harnessing it. So the only way that we're going to be able to do that without getting sidetracked, renunciation, isn't it? And bodhicitta to drive us. So visualization, really our friend, that kind of experience. Here's another one, like believing our body image. So now I've got a bit of a story here about this, our body image. Our body image actually is mapped onto our body. And so there's this story here. If anyone has that book, The Brain That Changes Itself, it's on page 187. And this guy who was a motorbike driver and had an accident and had his arm really smashed up. And it was so badly smashed up that they had to amputate his arm. And what happened was that he had phantom limb pain. So have you heard of that, where you don't have the arm anymore, but it's excruciating pain? And what can you do? The pain is there. There's not even anything to treat. So one of the people here, Ramachandran, he used this thing called a mirror box. And it's where you have, you put, say, for in this instance, you put a mirror down the middle of your body like this, so that it reflects your good arm, so that when you look in the mirror, it looks like you have two arms, even though you only have one, because the mirror is down. Is that perpendicular? Yep. Okay, so here's the story. So Philip was hurled from his motorbike, had a terrible accident, phantom arm, in excruciating pain. When Philip put his good arm into the mirror box, he not only began to see his phantom move, but he felt it moving for the first time. Amazed and overwhelmed with joy, Philip said he felt his phantom arm was plugged in again. Yet the moment he stopped looking at the mirror image or closed his eyes, the phantom froze. Ramachandran gave Philip the mirror box to take home to practice with, hoping Philip might unlearn his paralysis by stimulating a plastic change in his brain that would rewire his brain map. Philip used the box for 10 minutes a day, not much, folks, but it still seemed only to work when his eyes were open, looking at the mirror image of his good hand. Then, after 4 weeks, Ramachandran got an excited call from Philip. Not only was his phantom arm permanently unfrozen, it was gone, even when he wasn't using the box. Gone too was his phantom elbow and its excruciating pain. Only painless phantom fingers were left dangling from his shoulder. Ramachandran, the neurological illusionist, had become the first physician to perform a seemingly impossible operation, the successful amputation of a phantom limb. The mirror box appears to cure pain by altering the patient's perception of their body image. This is a remarkable discovery because it sheds light both on how our minds work and on how we experience pain. Pain and body image are closely related. We always experience pain as projected onto the body. When you throw your back out, you say, oh, my back's killing me, not my pain system is killing me. But as phantoms show, we don't need a body part or even pain receptors to feel pain. We need only a body image produced by our brain maps. People with actual limbs don't realize this because the body images of our limbs are perfectly projected onto our actual limbs, making it impossible to distinguish our body image from our body. Your own body is a phantom, says Ramachandran, one that your brain has constructed purely for convenience. So there's a few things about this, you know, when we have a body image where our image feels old, it ages us prematurely. Or if we have a body image where we think we're fantastic, then we can actually do a lot more than others with a similar kind of strength. There are times where it gets out of whack, the brain, the body map. So if anorexics cannot reconcile this extreme body image, their body image, their body map is huge, but their actual body is skeletal. And people think, well, I'll snap out of it, you know, like it's delusional, but it's not. It's actually, it's a real problem because what you actually experience is different from the skeleton. You can't actually see that skeletal form. Yeah, Tom. No, it's more, so this is more like when the mapping and the body get out of kilter. So actually it happens to a degree a bit. For instance, I think studies when women often have a body map that they think they're much fatter than they are, and men often have a body map that thinks they're much more buff and together than they actually are. So it kind of skews gender-wise, but that's to do with socialization. But it can be really traumatizing. For instance, if your body map is one of being male and you're in a female body. So this happens with a lot of trans people where you just think, I'm just in the wrong body. So it's where the body and the body map do not match, and just trying to force it isn't going to work. I mean, there's another incredible experiment where they had this person put both of their hands on the table. Then they put one hand underneath the table and they put a fake hand on top. So it still looks like there's two hands. Then they tickled the fake hand, and the one under the table felt the tickle. So they tickle the fake. So of course you have to be looking because for this to work. So you tickle the fake hand, feel the tickle, tickle the fake. But then they were really mean and they got a hammer and they went smash. Oh, and the person felt excruciating pain in their hand that was under the table, and nothing physically happened. They wouldn't allow that experiment now. Don't try this at home, kids. They did that with the mirror box as well. Okay, so thank you, lovely ladies, for coming. Bev will see you out, and I hope to see you again. I did, yes. We're almost on track. So, the body image. So all of our body maps are phantoms. So the conclusion from a tantric point of view is, well, why not adopt a really good body image, the body image of a Buddha, of a deity? Make that your body map. I mean, if it takes 10 minutes just to look at a fake hand on a table for you to experience it, if we're in imagination, we arise as the deity, we get that so clear, like with our internal visual sense, our visual awareness, we're going to remap our body like that. And Ben, I've got this question here from last time when you were doing this course, and you were talking, we might have been talking about doing a meditation. Do you self-generate or not self-generate? And actually, it's like we're all self-generating, but what we're self-generating is ordinary. ordinary beings. That's what we're mapping onto our body. So this thing of, it may seem kind of strange, mapping being a green lady or a blue man onto your body, but actually there's this really strong science behind it and a purpose. And if we understand what all of those, what the blue means, what all of the adornments mean, it's going to be a very powerful transformation for us. Okay, so now we're going to go one layer deeper. So we've got the body image. Now what about the emanating and absorbing lights, the deeds of a Buddha? So I've put together this page that'll be up on our on the website for our for the notes, because it's quite in depth and I can't read it all, but a lot of it comes from this book called The Intention Experiment. And so it's about light and how when we do this practice of emanating and absorbing lights, it's actually going to have a subtle physical effect. So there was a German physicist called Fritz Albert Popp who found that living things from really basic cells and trees, for instance, there's been an article recently about trees, emit constant tiny currents of photons, like little tiny particles of light. And people kind of think that this is like a communication channel, these photons, a way that organisms signal to themselves and the world. And I think it's called, these photons, it's called weak light. It's like a scientific term. And it's quite coherent, meaning that there's a organized frequency. So when subatomic particles are coherent, they become highly linked by bands of common electromagnetic fields, and they resonate like a multitude of tuning forks, all attuned to the same frequency. They stop behaving like anarchic individuals and begin operating like one well-rehearsed marching band. So I really like the language in this, because it's kind of, it's a nod to our own practice of stopping being anarchic individuals and attune ourselves to the bodhicitta intention. Coherence, this coherence of the light is like comparing photons of a single 60-watt light bulb to the sun. Ordinarily, light's very inefficient. The intensity of a light bulb is whatever, 1 watt per square centimetre of light. Lots of the light rays cancel each other out. The light generated per square centimetre by the sun is about 6,000 times stronger. But if you could get all the photons of one small light bulb to become coherent and resonate in harmony with each other, the energy density of a single light bulb would be thousands to millions of times higher than that of the surface of the sun. So that's how extraordinary it is if we can get that light to be coherent. So then there was another scientist, Schwartz, who discovered that directed attention, when we direct our attention, appears to manifest itself as electrical and magnetic energy and produce ordered streams of photons, these tiny little light particles, that are visible by measurable sensitive equipment. And he found that these photon streams become really strong emanating from the hands of healers, and they can be measured. So he thought that the source of healing was thoughts generated as frequencies, healing intention as well-ordered light. I mean, there's other things with light too. Lightning, for instance, and this is an analogy that I really love. You know, when lightning comes down, it's not just a one-sided thing. It's not that the lightning comes down. It comes down to wherever the object on the ground is arching up. So a lightning strike has a huge bit coming down and a tiny bit coming up. So if you're outside and your hair starts doing this, like run, because all of your bits are arching up and you're about to catch that lightning. But this is another thing that we can use in this analogy, that all we have to do is just a little bit of intentional focus in meditation.
But what would Stefan do?
What would Stefan do? That's right. That's right. He'd be okay. Maybe the beard would come out. Oh, right. The sand becomes a stalagmite on the beach. Right, that it comes up, becomes crystallized. Fantastic. So, you know, this is a thing that we're harnessing when we're meditating on emanating lights and absorbing them. So when we visualize the Buddha out there or the deity out there, and the light comes and purifies us, that's like the Buddha's lightning and our tiny little bit. And all we've got to do is just have that little bit of intention and we connect. We connect with the actual Buddhas. So on an ordinary level, all, you know, electric and magnetic fields decay. They're finite, just like our actions. They disintegrate. You know, they're really short term. They're all disordered and anarchic. On a quantum level, though, all of this stuff, it breaks down. Really strange things happen. Gravity changes. There's no barrier to light. We all emanate light as a subtle manifestation of intention just all the time. So let's use that. Not only that, but every object in the universe has a harmonic resonance. So, you know, when they do the thing with the champagne glasses, or the fat lady sings, the opera lady sings and all the windows break, that's the harmonic resonance. So Om Mani Padme Hum, it's a harmonic resonance of compassion. So there we can see it's like it's a really subtle form, a subtle energy. It's a physical thing, but it's subtle. The lights, they're a physical thing, but they're subtle. Your friend Om's to his newborn, that's great. Yeah. Well, he's just found his natural harmonic resonance, hasn't he? And I mean, if we had really good equipment, we could find each of our own harmonic resonance. It's just really hard to find that kind of sensitive equipment. So each of us would have our own mantra, in a way, our own harmonic resonance. Yeah, Ben.
I might have brought this up at this point in my
bag. Okay, so there's actual sounds, ASMR, that activate.
For me, it's actually my dishwasher. here in the background,
your dishwasher's got the magic tone.
There's a whole deal for ASMR that goes right into this.
Yeah, because sound is a subtle physical thing, as we know, and
it's a vibration.
Yeah, it can be physically measured, so it's a physical thing. I don't know if the higher emotions would have a blissful ones would have a higher frequency, because I was listening to the birds and the cats, and when they're happy it's like da da da, then danger comes. See, I think that's more associations, but this is like we're sticking with like hard measurable science here. it's all incredibly mysterious. The world is a wonderful and mysterious place. And with all of these scientific things, we can see not only how it connects, but actually if we use it, it's going to naturally lead to Buddhahood. Because the elements are there. So first we do it in imagination, and then later on it's going to actually manifest on an energetic level. So this is when we get into Highest Yoga Tantra. It's like, you know, first in imagination, but it's imagination that is a correct body map. It actually matches perfectly with the reality. Whereas the body map that we have at the moment, it's a phantom and it's limited, it's ordinary. Oh, yeah, synesthesia, where you have a connection of a sound and a colour. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. The numbers have a shape and a colour. And not only that, the numbers exist in a vast field.
Yes.
So, again, that's like the real fundamental essence building blocks of our physical world, actually, you know, right there on the edge of the existential world, and doesn't exist in a vacuum, it exists in a field. I remember there's an article about these two great mathematicians, brothers, and people would just ask them a question and 3 days later they'd come and they'd say the answer, and they just put the question in the landscape of their mind. And they just walk through the landscape and they'd find the answer. It was really amazing. So for us too, it's like when we imagine the mandala of a Buddha, it's like the landscape in our mind, but it's an experiential landscape. It's not like a physical one. And so we can, it's like navigating through experiences and memories and associations. It's sensory, but it's inner space. Happens in our mind. And of course, with a Buddha, it's perfected. There's no faults there. So we're not going to fall over and trip, no, break our ankle or anything. It's like, it's perfect. You know what? For me, 67 is like my death number. I miss it out when I count. I never counted it. It's terrible if I'm trying to count lines. Yeah, so there you go. Who knows? Okay, so we've gone around a huge array of the world tonight. We've looked at the four Buddha bodies, or if we're going to divide them into two, the body and mind of a Buddha, and how they have to be accomplished simultaneously. So substantial causes for the Dharmakaya, they're there in all the meditations, wisdom, realizing emptiness. But substantial causes for the Rupakaya are these four: the mandala, meditating on the mandala, a pure environment, meditating on the form, the body of light, making and meditating on the offerings, the enjoyments, and then the activities of a Buddha, emanating and absorbing lights, and making that as natural as breathing. And so we do it all through visualization, but it's a lot more than just play acting. It's like this transformative method. Changes our experience so we feel better. That's the minimum. At the end of the meditation, we feel better. But it rewires our brain, our body map, and it primes our nervous system to experience things differently. So before we have our dedications, do you have any last questions? Yes, Lily.
I have a question.
The Tantra doesn't refute that. It just goes more in depth. So from a Mahayana Sutra point of view, that's correct, and that's what you do. But Mahayana Tantra goes in a step deeper. So one is like having the picture of the plans, and the other is like having the actual plans and building it. So when it comes to actually doing it, there's more to it. So remember, each of the, you know, in the Lam Rim, it's always the practices in common with the lower scope, the practices in common with the middle scope. Then it's actually like the practices in common with Mahayana Sutra, because all of the Lam Rim is taught from the point of view of Tantra. So we're not refuting Sutra. We're just saying more detail. Yeah, that's right. The perfections are the substantial causes for the Rupakaya, but not quite. So from the point of view of Sutra, they are. From the point of view of Tantra, they're not.
I don't understand.
Because they have to turn into the form. Substantial causes, it turns into it. So they can't turn into it. But you can't say it's wrong. It's from a different point of view. So how I get my head around it, it's like when you're studying biology, chemistry, physics. They're really different, but they don't refute each other. So from the point of view of biology, you know, from the point of view of chemistry, biology is really quite rough. From the point of view of physics, well, chemistry is quite rough. Well, from the point of view of maths, everything's quite rough. But maths doesn't even have its physical, you know, form. So it's right out there. Maths is kind of equivalent to Dharmakaya in a way. So they don't refute each other. They help, they actually support each other. Okay. Yes, I think Tantra is very much like the quantum field of possibility. Yep. Okay. Recommended reading, Tara the Liberator by Lama Zopa Rinpoche, pages 13 to 17. And if you can, the FPMT notes, read up to page 25. And so next week we're going to look at more of the nuts and bolts of it, the path of Action Tantra. So next week is Action Tantra, and then the following week is Highest Yoga Tantra. So those of you that are, you know, thinking about these initiations, they're really quite different paths, quite different approaches. Lily, you know, like you were saying, they might actually even seem contradictory, like which one's right, but they're just really different. So we'll start with the lower tantras. And within that is understanding the structure of a sadhana, because if we have any sadhana practices or any meditation practice at all, there's this beautiful structure to it. And if we understand the substantial causes, we'll really appreciate it. So let's dedicate, let's take all of our efforts in our trip around the universe and dedicate that we can achieve the two Buddha bodies, you know, the mind of a Buddha, the Dharmakaya, and the physical expression of a Buddha, so that sentient beings can connect, so we can help them, that we can achieve the state of Vajradhara, the light body, and also so that we can emanate in whatever form is necessary to help sentient beings. Cham choy sem chor in poche, ma ke panam ke yue chi, ke wan yang pa me pa ya, con e con tu pe wa shon. Chi te kam ti pen te ma lu pa, kam le cho we sang pe yi. Kadri so me tenzing ya so la so wa dem so tuen shi lon dru shu Jo so chan jin jen gong ya we tenzing kong bel we kong so do po se Thanks everyone for hanging in there.